You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, and welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Take a look at the Atlanta Braves. We're breaking down that Tuki Toussaint, Bronson Arroyo trade, as well as checking in on prospect Malik Smith. We talk Marlins. We'll be taking a look at some of those intriguing young starters and some stagnating young hitters. We talk Mets. We'll be taking a look at Wilmer Flores' apparent imminent move to second base and what that tells us about the organization as a whole. We're breaking down the managerial change with the Phillies, and we talk Nationals. We'll be looking at Steven Strasburg, Max Scherzer, and Joe Ross.
Bill, the results were awfully good from Steven Strasburg in his debut. I saw most of it, and I liked what I saw. What did you see from Strasburg in his return to the mound?
I thought I saw the old Steven Strasburg. Threw a lot of fastballs. His clocked as high as like 97 miles an hour. The good thing was that he challenged the Braves, and the Braves fouled off a lot of pitches. I mean, you know, and I thought going five innings was good enough, and hopefully in the next outing he can go deeper than five. But I thought the confidence was back, and that's a good sign.
Yeah, if there was one thing, if you were going to nitpick one thing, it was the efficiency. He definitely was not efficient. And if you wanted to be mildly concerned about that, I could see that, as you noted, finishing guys off. And it seems like that's really been, not that exactly, but Strasburg's issue this year has sort of been when he gets in trouble not getting out of it. As we look forward and see what he's got coming up and what the kind of how he should move forward, what's the level of confidence from the club going forward that over the next 3.5 months he's going to be the pitcher we saw in previous years?
Well, obviously they believe in Strasburg, because if they did, they would have set Joe Ross down. I think the confidence is definitely there by the team. I'm expecting Strasburg, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm expecting him to be the Steven Strasburg I'm used to seeing, especially from last year. No issues, go deep in games, get a lot of strikeouts, which he hasn't really done this year. But I think it'll be different going forward.
This is a deep team, and part of why people were so high on them in the offseason was the completeness of them. They have a deep lineup. They've got a deep rotation. They've got a good bullpen. They should catch the ball pretty well. This is a club that doesn't really come down to one thing. With that said, how much different does this team look when it's got its rotation intact and strong? It just seems like that really is what everything feeds off of. When this team wins, it's going to win starting with the rotation.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no question. And it's strong right now. I mean, they haven't given up a run in 34 and a third innings. That's a lot of innings. And, you know, Matthew, you know, as you talk about the pitching staff, and the starting staff is definitely great, but I just hope that the bullpen can be consistent. I mean, Drew Storen has been great, but everyone else has been up and down. Hopefully they found their eighth-inning guy in David Carpenter. But other than that, I mean, this team should really win this division. I expected the team to win the division primarily because of the pitching staff, and it seemed like every time they put a starter out there, they're going to go deep. And it's going to be hard for them, for opposing teams, to really get a run. And it's going to be tough.
It was a big deal when they added Max Scherzer. I was somebody who, I mean, obviously Scherzer is a very good pitcher. I was not quite as high on him as some people were. I'll admit that. I'll wear that. I didn't think he was a bum or bad signing, but I just wasn't quite sure he was that absolute flagship, this is the guy you build a rotation around. And he has been that and more. He has been, I think pretty clearly, the best pitcher in baseball through 2.5 months. Is there anything you can point to that is the difference between the very good pitcher who pitched for the Tigers and won a Cy Young, but even then, you know, was, I want to be really careful here, this guy is a very, very good pitcher even before this year. But I think if you were naming the best, you're naming Felix Kershaw, that tier, you wouldn't have put Scherzer there before this year. He's there now. Is there something you can point to that has taken him from very, very good to, so far, the best pitcher in the major leagues?
Matthew, I think it's very simple. I went to Ryan Zimmerman's gala on Monday, And I thought that Max Scherzer gave me that answer. It's Max Scherzer, the man. Max Scherzer wants to get better. You know, I approached him and I said, I feel that this is your best year. I know you want to Cy Young. This is your best year so far. And he said he wants to get better. He said there's more to improve on. I mean, this is a guy who has a DRA under 2, and he wants to improve. And, I mean, it seems like every time he's on that mound, he's going to no-hit somebody. I mean, this is not just Milwaukee and not just Pittsburgh. I even thought all year. And, I mean, I would like to see what he would like to improve on. He wouldn't reveal that to me. But I think he wants to get better and better. And, number one, be the best pitcher in all baseball. That's the bottom line.
One thing that stands out, one sort of obvious thing to point to in the stats, is that he had one complete game before 2015. He has two in the last week and a half. Is that a matter of just being willing to push a guy who has reached a certain age and kind of gotten through that injury nexus? Is there something in his command that's allowing him to be more efficient? Is there something where he's finishing guys off more quickly? What has allowed him to go from a guy who doesn't finish games to a guy who does?
I think it's efficiency. I mean, look at the pitch count. I mean, unlike Detroit, you got to remember, too, it's a different league. I mean, you had to deal with the DH. Here you're dealing with the pitcher's league. Obviously, you know, Max Scherzer is taking advantage of it. And, again, look at his pitch count. I mean, his pitch count is always down. And I'll never forget when he signed, I was getting emails from fans and people who watched him pitch in the media say he was going to go no more than seven innings. And obviously, to me, Scherzer had a different game plan going in because, obviously, he's going deep in games. He's in a different league, and he's taking advantage of what's going on in the new league.
He's never been a guy that walked a ton of guys, but he has, you know, walked 50 or 60 a season. He's been it's never been a problem, but he hasn't been this level of never walking anybody. I mean, he's sort of taken that to a level that's really kind of the difference in a lot of ways. His numbers kind of look like a peak Curt Schilling season, where the strikeouts are high and the walks are microscopic. Is that an approach thing? Is that just a developing into locating better? What has allowed him to walk so many fewer guys this year?
I think his location. You know, and also, too, the most important stat to him is first pitch strikes. And it seems like he's getting a lot of first pitch strikes. And once he gets strike one, he wants to finish them off right away. He doesn't waste time. And I think that was a goal. He said that since spring training. And I really believe this, Matthew, that once he gets strike one, it's like forget nibbling, forget getting to a 3-2 count. Let's get him out now and take it from there.
In the meantime, as they have been dealing with some guys out, Joe Ross was really excellent. I believe we talked about him last week, but
yes.
Would they send him out? Is there a role for him later this year? I know you want to get a guy like that innings. He's young, he's developing, but for a team that saw this really impressive pitcher and that has a bullpen need, not now, but later in the year, is there some chance we could see Ross return as a reliever for this team?
Matt Williams announced that won't happen. They want to see him as a starter. And, you know, I think with Jordan Zimmermann leaving next year, I think we're going to see Joe Ross in that rotation. You know, the Nationals are really – they're prepared for the Jordan Zimmermann's league because we're going to see Joe Ross, you know – maybe get a chance to be in that rotation. The Nationals are well prepared for next year. Joe Ross is one of them.
The Nationals have been mentioned really over the winter, but again recently in rumors with Ben Zobrist. Do you think there's anything to that? Do you think Zobrist is a guy who intrigues them?
I don't, Matthew, because, you know, like, you know, I asked someone in the organization, and they said right now it's not true. Now, that could change, but they believe he's a step slower right now because he's coming off a knee injury right now. But maybe if once he gets healthy, things will change. So I would say, you know, right before the deadline, you know, maybe something could happen. But right now, I would say no.
So I think it's at least a good sign that there's so much talk about the weird things going on around the Mets. It means they're interesting. It means people care. It means that they're worth watching. With that said, there's a lot of strange stuff that's been going on around this team all year long. The latest is something you just wrote about after emphatically saying, Wilmer Flores is a shortstop. Wilmer Flores is a shortstop. We are not going to mess with this. Wilmer Flores is a shortstop. Suddenly, maybe Wilmer Flores is not going to continue to be a shortstop. Where does that stand right now?
It stands that he's probably not going to be a shortstop for much longer. It sounds like as soon as Daniel Murphy comes back from the DL, he'll come back to third base, and the Mets are strongly considering flopping Ruben Tejada and Wilmer Flores, at least for now. Tejada would play short, and Flores would play second. Now, the weird thing about that is, you know, if you're going to do it, you don't really need to wait for Murphy to come back, because while Tejada's been playing some third base, you could still do that now, and you wouldn't have to be you wouldn't really have to mess with anyone else. So the timing, I think it's just sort of a landmark that they're looking at, that they can do this, and it's almost like an excuse to do it. But in terms of, you know, how you brought the topic up, yeah, it's weird. They were emphatic about it. They've been defending the move really for 2 years now, since they first moved Wilmer Flores to shortstop in the minors. Give him time, give him time. And he has gotten better. He's still making some head-scratching plays on a pretty regular basis. The errors don't. Haven't really happened that much since earlier in the season. But it's not like anything's really changed. I don't think he's playing any better or worse than he has been all year, and really for a lot of last year. So it is weird to do an about-face like this, but it's also the first time the Mets have done some head-scratching things, so I guess we'll see how it unfolds and how it works out.
Is it reasonable to draw a line to this being at least partly about Tejada? And the reason I say that is, I think, you know, we discussed shortstop so much over the winter, and the answer pretty consistently on Ruben Tejada was, he's not an option. It's just not happening. That ship has sailed. Is part of what's going on here that Ruben Tejada, through his play, has maybe reestablished himself as a shortstop option?
He's definitely reestablished himself in the short term. I mean, he's been playing almost every day, and he's deserves to, relative to the other guys around him. I still don't see him as a long-term answer for this team. I think Matt Reynolds is going to be here at some point this year. And, that could have been at second base, because it's not like Matt Reynolds, one of their top hitting infield prospects, is much of a defensive standout himself. But now it could be at shortstop. And maybe they've seen all they care to see but from Flores, and they want to see what Matt Reynolds can do. Maybe he can be better. Because, again, you know, while the errors have stopped for Flores, he is still doing some things on a near daily basis that make you say, I'm not so sure. I mean, he's very slow turning the double plays around the bag. There was that play in Atlanta over the weekend where he just kind of froze and really changed the course of the entire game. It's just things like that don't necessarily show up on the box score. They do show up in some of the advanced metrics, where Flores is a -5 in terms of defensive run saved, which is worse than all but one National League shortstop. So you understand why they would want to do a shakeup. I think most people thought it was a long time coming, and I think most fans wanted this to happen a long time ago. So I guess it's progress. It's just a weird way for this to come about. But to answer your question, I still don't think Ruben Tejada is a long-term answer at either middle infield position for the Mets.
Between this sequence of events and the similarly weird and, frankly, somewhat similar sequence of events regarding the six-man rotation, is it fair for somebody outside, somebody such as myself watching from a few hundred miles away, just to kind of wonder about what's going on organizationally here? I mean, look, I've been around teams, and I know that you defend what you're doing. I understand that. You part of how a club succeeds is by not saying, well, we don't really have any good options. We're going to try this. You say, look, this is what we're doing. We're committed to it. And I understand that. But this is twice in the span of a month where something that was, hey, we're doing this, or hey, we're not doing this, never mind. Is it fair to at least ask those questions about what this kind of says about change of command or communication or organization or whatever it may be?
Of course it is. And of all those things you mentioned, I think maybe organization might be the biggest one, because I don't think there's any question about who's in charge here. And I guess communication has been an issue as well, maybe not necessarily internally, but how they communicate stuff to us in the media. The team can tend to get mad at how things are portrayed, but it's how they've been presented to us, and then they do an about face, and they say, well, that's not what we had in mind from the beginning. I don't know what – I can't pinpoint an exact problem for you, why these things are happening, why the Mets say we're going to a six-man rotation. No, wait, no, we're not. Oh, yeah, wait, yes, we are. All I can tell you is that it's clear there's no lineation here. There's no direct line where the Mets have this grand plan for the season and they're just following it, because things are changing on the fly. Don't let anyone fool you. It's not as if they've just been going on one line this entire time and this is the plan that they laid out in spring training. It's not. Things are changing on a monthly, weekly, daily basis. And a lot of players, be it Wilmer Flores or Dylan G or whoever else, are getting caught up in it. And these players were not aware of the changes when they happened. I mean, I think that's why we talked last week about how upset Dylan G was, and did that play a role in him getting DFA'd? Well, I don't think it played a role, but I do think he was upset because he didn't see this coming, and I think there's a lot of that going on here where players don't necessarily see it coming. So maybe communication is an issue, but yeah, I just think there's a lot of reactiveness going on. I think there's a lot of knee-jerk, short-term things. One thing's not working out, so they quickly flip the switch and try something else, without really giving the first thing a chance. And it's a dangerous road to go down. I think you kind of need to stick to your guns. I think you kind of need to, as a front office, as management, on-field management, whatever, if you commit to one thing, you can't just turn around a couple days later and do something else. So that's certainly something the Mets have struggled with this season, and we'll see how it goes going forward, especially coming into the trade deadline and all that. We'll see how that reactiveness manifests itself.
How does all of this play in the clubhouse? Because I know to some extent these guys say, look, I don't read it, I don't care what you guys write, but one of the things that I think often does sit poorly or sort of make players wonder is inconsistency, indecisiveness. Does any of this play weirdly beyond the guys who are directly involved? And obviously, if you're directly involved, you say, well, what's going on here? But is there a point where within the clubhouse, guys start wondering, what exactly is the direction here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you saw it with the six-man rotation where there was a conga line of starting pitchers going into Terry Collins' office asking what the heck was going on. That's not an ideal situation to be in as a manager. I think anytime you come to work and you're not sure what exactly you're going to do, you're going to question about it. Some guys, like a Matt Harvey, who has a stronger personality, might be a little more vocal about it. Other guys might just put their head down and say, okay, I guess this is what I'm doing today. You look at some of the better teams in the league, I think that's definitely a theme. There's some consistency. Guys come in and don't necessarily, even guys who aren't playing every day, don't necessarily come in wondering what their role is going to be. They have a pretty good idea of it. You could argue whether or not that actually affects performance on the field, but when it becomes a consistent week in, week out, month in, month out, and even, over the course of years with this front office administration, with this on-field management administration, I think definitely it's a concern. And it's certainly not the reason why the Mets haven't made the playoffs in all these years, and why they're struggling all of a sudden now to make a run at this thing when they started out so hot. I don't think it helps. It doesn't.
To touch on one last concrete thing before we roll, and to kind of circle back a little bit, you mentioned that there's been some talk of the Flores move coinciding with Daniel Murphy returning. What is his status? How close is he? Where is that at right now?
He should be back at some point this weekend. And initially people had thought maybe this week, maybe even last weekend. He progressed a little slower. I don't think that's any surprise to anyone who's followed Mets injuries that first date the team pinpoints doesn't tend to be the one it actually is. But barring some sort of actual physical setback, he should be there this weekend for the series against the Reds. And, you hope if you're the Mets, because he was by far your best hitter. But prior to going on the DL, that he stays active and healthy going forward here.
Mark, the Braves made one of the most interesting and unusual trades that we've seen in baseball in quite a long time. It actually read a lot like an NBA trade, where they say things like the expiring contract of, rather than saying the player. First of all, can you just, because I think there were a lot of people who probably, if you don't really follow, it was a baffling trade. So first of all, just what were the Braves trying to accomplish in acquiring Touki Toussaint and Bronson Arroyo for Phil Gosselin?
Well, obviously from the Braves, and that this was an attempt just to further strengthen the pitching prospect crop that they have compiled, you know, over the last few months. They look at Toussaint as a guy who would have been, you know, that they would have loved to have got him in the first round last year. It seemed as a guy probably ranks as their second or third best pitching prospect now immediately. A guy who could, you know, get in the rotation 2018-2019. They have a long-term plan, whereas the D-backs were, as Tony LaRusso said earlier this week, they were looking for an impact much sooner. They feel like that the $10 million they saved there is going to help them make that an immediate acquisition that's going to benefit them in 2016. But it was a baffling trade. The one thing I will say, you know, I take a step back, and obviously you know Tony LaRusso as well as any of us. I respect his knowledge. The one thing I'd have to that I keep in the back of my mind is when you see a trade where it doesn't make any sense, you have to wonder what that team knows about that player, having lived with them for, you know, a year or two. What have they learned that allowed them to say, hey, you know what, he's the guy with us that we're willing to get rid of. So we'll see. I mean, all indications are that Toussaint could be definitely a number two potential ace in the future. But right now he is a project, but that's what the Braves are trying to do. They want to get as many pitchers in that stable as possible, with the hope that, just at least a few of them hit.
It's funny, as you well remember, that's what people used to say about the Braves. When the Braves traded you a pitcher, you wonder what was wrong with him. Toussaint is an interesting guy, because as highly regarded as he was in the draft last year, you know, first of all, just, well, why are these guys willing to part with him? But it does seem like there were some kind of mixed reviews, and it seems like there's a little mystery surrounding his development. There were reports that the Diamondbacks wouldn't let him throw his curveball and that was his best pitch. There's some I've seen, I'm reading Twitter and a lot of third-hand stuff, but some suggestion that maybe his velocity wasn't up this year where people hoped it would be. Where is he at? I mean, on the one hand, the simple answer is he's a long way off. But as far as his development, as far as what this guy is a year after being drafted, what's your understanding of how he's progressed and what he's shown and why there might be worries about him?
You know, you touched on it there. Yes, they did. He has thrown the curveball much less frequently. That's supposed to be his prize secondary pitch. We asked about that immediately after the trade. And John Coppolella said, look, on Friday, the trade happened on a Saturday. The previous night, he had thrown six scoreless innings. He said he threw about five curveballs that night. So in other words, he was throwing it, but from what I understand, the D-backs wanted him to focus on the changeup, and so they got him away from throwing the curveball. But, you know, that just seemed to be more of an organizational decision. There have been reports that he's a guy that he's touched 96, but at the same time, other people have said he hasn't been in that vicinity this year. I think, once again, when you break this down, this is a 19-year-old kid. You don't know where he's going. He played a lot of soccer growing up. He's still pretty relatively young in the baseball world. I mean, in terms of his arm is fresh because he hasn't played as much baseball as maybe some of the other guys, the other 19-year-old top prospects. But, it is going to be interesting to see once he gets in the Braves system and starts pitching, do they change it? We'll see why he hasn't been throwing the curveball as frequently, where his velocity is. But, the Braves do do believe that that this guy has tremendous upside. That they look at him the same way they did Max Fried, a kid who potentially could be the number two, or maybe develop into that ace in the future.
One of the things that has happened in the last few years in the baseball economy is that the opportunity to flex muscle in the amateur market has radically diminished and is almost gone, that opportunity, if a club wants to really invest heavily in amateur talent. The draft slotting is a lot stricter than it used to be, so you can't wait for that signability question kid and then sign him for $5 million out of the fourth round. Bonuses, the July 2nd bonuses have been drastically limited. And so there's a lot fewer ways. If you want to be an organization that is building the way it appears the Braves want to, you want to be an organization that builds on amateur talent, on scouting and development, the opportunities to do that are fewer and fewer. I should say the opportunities to spend to do that are fewer and fewer. The opportunities to invest your money in that priority. That's a very long intro to a question of, is this an indication that the Braves are going to try to find additional creative ways to make that happen? Or put another way, is this maybe not the last time they'll do something unusual and creative and willing to spend money to bolster that pipeline?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the nail on the head there, but this was one way for them to you can kind of go this way with a team that's looking to dump money. You take on a salary that or a contract that they do not want in order to get that high-end prospect that you wouldn't have been able to get in the draft year before or whatever the case. And yes, do I expect them to make similar deals in the future? They've got a couple kids lined up for the July 2nd international signing date where they're going to go over their bonus pool. And I expect at some point within the next few weeks, a month, they're going to go ahead and make some more deals that will help them with the bonus pool, because they have a very highly regarded guy that they'd like to target in 2016. So I think that you will continue to see John Coppola try to be as creative as he can with these kind of trades, just to set themselves up to get high-end young prospects.
Is there any chance that Bronson Arroyo throws even a pitch in a Braves uniform?
Yeah, a chance. Yes, there's a chance. I think that the best way to describe Bronson Arroyo, if he helps them win one game this year, that'll be gravy. I mean, this is a deal that was targeted directly towards Toussaint, and Arroyo says he doesn't know if he'll pitch. The Braves would be happy if he just even logs a few innings for him, just to help out there at some point in September.
And one other name from that Braves pipeline, noted a couple days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, it all kind of runs together for me, Malik Smith was promoted. He's off to a really nice start. I know they liked him coming in, but what has he shown them in his first half season in the organization?
Here's a guy who has got an on base with great frequency there at the Double-A level. What I have heard from some scouts is, look, here's an exciting player with tremendous upside. They want to see how does that speed play against a little bit better defense. Does the bunt single? Does it play against a better third baseman? Or even just some better arms that maybe he runs into with a couple of the infield singles. He's a high speed guy. I don't want to put him right exactly in the Billy Hamilton category, because I think he's got some broader shoulders, maybe a little bit more power potential than Billy Hamilton. But what they've also seen is a kid who has played better defense than we saw during spring training. Look, he can race gap to gap, but what he has shown is better discipline. It's going to be interesting to see how his move to center field or move to Gwinnett, where he'll play center field on the primary base, will affect the future of Cameron Maven, who has lived up to the expectations that you accurately predicted back in April. without Cameron Maven, I don't know where the Braves would be right now. But at the same time, I get the sense that they'll look to see if, so high on him. It may be here before the July trade deadline or at some point during the offseason, because this team does need a power hitter that they can place in left field. So Maven or Julio Teheran are two pieces I could see them moving. The other guy whose future, Malik Smith, the promotion to Gwinnett, it directly affects right now is Jose Peraza, who was spending some time out in center field. Now he'll go back to playing second base. They've already made every indication that Jace Peterson is their second baseman of the future, and he has continued to excel since they made that statement about a month ago. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do with Peraza. Could he be a trade piece? Maybe, but that has never been expressed by any team official. But as we've seen, this John Coppola, John Hart front office, they're never afraid to make a trade, and they are very capable of being very creative.
Joe, it's early in the season in the long view, but it's getting a little late when we start talking non-waiver trade deadline. It's 5 weeks to the deadline. Marlins are 9.5 back and not really getting any traction. And perhaps most concerning, the Nationals look like they are. They look like they're getting it together. Now, everything could change in a week, and I think that's worth noting that this whole picture could look a lot different in even 1 week. But how does this team view the next 5 weeks as it determines strong buy, light buy, sell, however they approach the next 5 weeks? What's their viewpoint on where they stand right now?
Well, Matthew, they've been pretty adamant that they're not out of it, that they can, turn this thing around. Nothing's really indicating that is what's going to happen. But I think it's key to note here, Matthew, and the other day in Cincinnati, I was talking to Michael Hill, president of baseball ops, that this is a team that they kind of have built to be sustainable for a few years. This year, obviously, injury-riddled, managerial issue early on. Some guys have underperformed, namely, Yelich and Ozuna and the outfield guys they had big hopes for. Michael Morris has been hurt. And they're just – I don't think they want to quit on this. I think one of the reasons DJ is here managing is trying to figure this team out. So, yeah, I mean, there's really showing nothing other than get Jose back and then maybe some of these other starters and then pick it up. They're highly frustrated at the offense being this underperforming, considering you have two starters in the All-Star game and, a leadoff guy has been as good as any in that position this year, and then the biggest slugger in the game doing what he's doing. And, it's just not calculating. So they're hopeful, optimistic, but, if you're getting towards what are they going to do, I kind of see them not really doing much other than just kind of letting this thing play out and letting these players seem to figure it out. Now, they're going to have to do something pitching-wise only because, once a few of these other pitchers come back in, they're going to have to make roster moves. So I think pitching is going to sort itself out. I don't see them making major trades, in terms of at least guys under control for more than this year. And that doesn't mean it won't happen, but they're certainly not in buy mode. They're not going to give up the farm for Papelbon. They're just kind of trying to get their identity, which has been non-existent all year.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff packed in here, and I will start with the pitching staff, and I thought it was really intriguing that a team that's got a lot of uncertainty and a lot of shuffling going on in its rotation brings Jared Cosart back, but brings him back to the bullpen, and I thought that was really strange and at least a yellow flag. What does that say? What's the indication there?
There's a lot of real confusion, and right now, I can't imagine Jose Urania is going to stay in the rotation. And I can't imagine that Jared Cosart is going to stay in the bullpen. I mean, his last couple of starts and rehab assignments were 100-something pitches. You don't build him up like that to make him a one or a long relief type of guy. Now, there were some command things and issues mechanically that they're hoping to iron out in his rehab assignment. So, it's going to be curious to see. Urania's, would be lined up to go Sunday, but they are TBA right now. Urania's too good of a prospect to go to the bullpen. So if they don't see him in the rotation, I think pretty soon he's going to have to go to AAA again and then start every, you know, fifth day. So I don't imagine it's going to be very long for Cozart in the bullpen. But, yeah, it is strange, and it's, you know, there's a lot of kind of mixed messages here going to a lot of players, and there's a lot of confusion, and that's not really an ideal clubhouse environment.
Yeah, and you mentioned Urania, who's an interesting guy, and he's been more or less decent, but, you know, 15 Ks and 13 walks and 37 innings to me is not an indication of a guy who is ready to be in a big league rotation.
Correct.
Now. So, I mean, I guess my first question is, what do they think they've seen from him at the big league level? Are they pleased? Is it clear that there's more development that needs to be done? What do they see when they look at what he's done at the big league level so far?
Yeah, and what they see is what's consistent with some scouts I respect and talk to about him as well. Kind of this guy they envision as a number three. And considering he's an international signing who they signed at, what, 16 years old several years ago, they're very pleased with what they have there. He's made tremendous strides. As much as any pitcher I've seen in their organization, coming from an area where very thin kid, really unpolished, to a kid who's still slender, but looks like he, you know, he's got a big league arm. But the secondary pitches, the command of the breaking ball, and I think the Yankees, even though his line wasn't bad against the Yankees, the fact that they stacked up to start to go all left-handers against him, and he had a real hard time against them, you know, sent up something like, wow, there's some holes in there in how these guys can see the ball, and their just lack of confidence that he could repeatedly throw his breaking balls for strikes. So, yeah, there's still some refining and fine-tuning that's going to have to go on. But I think they envision, he's just, what, 23 years old. This kid is going to be a really good pitcher in the big leagues, but he's an unfinished product and was called up because of injuries at a tough time. And, you know, I see him going down in the not-too-distant future and, you know, coming back probably in September, or if injury, you know, dictates something else. But, you know, I think this is a kid that has a real upside but isn't there right yet.
One guy who is further along is Justin Nicolino. He got his first taste. That from talking to you and reading your stuff, the indication was that they were not in any hurry to start getting him big league starts. But is it a situation where either he or injuries have kind of forced their hand? Is he going to maybe stick around for a while?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, Matthew, because even though the story when he started in Cincinnati and made his debut, he had been – okay, he was kind of on call because Kohler had a little bit of the neck issue coming out of his start in New York. But he was lined up to pitch, you know, like on a five-day, like always. But they held him like 7 days. And they could have called up someone else. If this was just going to be a spot start, they have guys like Kendrys Flores, who got called up earlier, who was absolutely lined up with Kohler and could have made that start. So even though they kind of said it was a spot start, I looked at it a little differently because they've handled this kid with kid gloves more than anyone that I can remember as a high pitching prospect for the Marlins. And they got past the, you know, that arbitration, you know, Super 2 date. So, okay, I get that part. And then they bring him up, and he came as advertised. Obviously, he's not going to strike a ton out, but, you know, the dart throwing, the ability to work both sides of the plate, the pitching smart, it just kind of wowed everyone to do what he did in Cincinnati, which, you know, clearly it wasn't a spot start because now he's going to get a second start. And I think he's going to get a third start. You know, I think, you know, this kid is – there's a real lot to like there. You know, again, you know, he's not an ace. He's not electric. He's profiling as a three or four. But, you know, he's a lefty, which they don't have. So I think if they could kind of get him sandwiched, let's say, between like a – Jose Fernandez, who's going to be throwing 98, 99, and he comes in with his 92 with cut, and, you know, in a series, that's going to be a totally different look from one night to the next. So I think Justin Nicolino is going to be here for a while.
And, you know, we have understandably spent a lot of this year really talking about the rotation, talking about the guys on the way, talking about who's not there and will be back soon, talking about the performances of the guys who are there. But this team's basically middle of the pack in run prevention. They've been all right. The rotation, even with the guys they've shuttled in, it's been all right. It's pretty clear the issue here is with the offense. And to me, what really stands out is the guys who are already here. It's not people they brought in. It's you look at Yelich, who has been a little better but hasn't really found any traction. You look at Ozuna, who's having a really disappointing year. What's going on with this core of young hitters who are really supposed to be the key to a breakout for this team?
Yeah, they're kind of, I believe, Matthew, kind of caught up in a lot of frustration. And, you know, with their performance, with Marlins Park, I mean, anyone that saw the game where Stanton hits a 379-foot single off the top of the ball and right, which would be out of pretty much everywhere, you know, it's these type of things are happening to the players, and they're not, you know, to be honest, they're handling it as well as they should. And you start now expanding your strike zone, trying to do more. Being with Prado's injury, and it looks like he's going to be out a while, Matthew, and he's a situational guy and just kind of a, you know, silent leader who will get the clutch hit for you. You know, they need that. I mean, Derek Dietrich's done a nice job coming in, providing the long ball, but they need the long ball, but they need a better approach. They need to just kind of grind it out, get to that Marlins Park, let's just hit the ball hard and hit it in the gap, rather than just get frustrated by Marlins Park and then, you know, take it out in the road and see a short, you know, porch in Cincinnati and overswing and go out of the zone there. It's a collective fail.
Todd, an hour or so ago, as far as anybody knew, Ryan Sandberg was going to be the manager of the Phillies at least till the end of the year. Now he didn't even make it till tonight's game. I think the first question is, and again, with the acknowledgement that this is very fresh and we don't really know a lot, what do you think brought Sandberg to this point where he would step down?
Well, he said two things during the press conference. The first thing he said is the loss has got to me, and I imagine that is true. This guy's a Hall of Fame player. Despite, you know, he played for the Cubs all these years, a lot of losing teams. But this team was very, very poor, obviously worst record in baseball when he resigned, and I think it did get to him. But he also said something which I thought was very interesting. He said, I see that changes are coming. And, you know, Andy McPhail is going to be named to some sort of key front office role in the next few days. Certainly within the week. And I think he saw with Andy McPhail's arrival, there could be a new general manager. And with that, there's very likely going to be a new manager. So in my opinion, I think he kind of looked at the entire situation, said, you know, I'm going to manage this team through the rest of the year and probably not come back. You know, I might as well just step down now and let somebody else take over. That's my opinion. I'm thinking, but he did say several times during that press conference, changes are coming in the front office, and that was something that I had to consider.
This is a fine line, and ultimately it doesn't really matter. But when he says stuff like that, do you think this is a matter of almost altruism, like, hey, I know you guys got to get on with it, I'm not going to stand in the way and kind of do what's best for the organization? Or do you think this is more a sense of, once all this is going, I'm a lame duck anyway, if they're not going to stand up and say he's our guy, then I may as well get on because there's no, it's not worth it anyway.
Yeah, I tend to think it's the latter, Matthew. I think he looked at it more as, you know, I haven't really gotten a great vote of confidence. Pat Gillick talked to me on Sunday and Bob Brookover from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and both of his quotes were similar. Said he was kind of doing a good job, but you could also make the argument that he wasn't doing a good job. And I think that probably stuck out to Ryan, like, oh, okay, this is what they're saying now. I'm probably going to finish the season, so what are they going to say, you know, after the season when Andy McPhail probably takes over in the Pat Gillick role and they bring in a new general manager? So, again, my gut tells me that he saw the writing on the wall here, and rather than, hey, you know what, let me just step aside and you guys can continue on towards the future, I think it was more of the, you know what, I can tell I'm not the guy, so, you know, I should just move on.
They named Pete McCann interim manager, which he's got to be now the all-time record for most stints as an interim manager of a major league club. But they said even that, it sounded like, was only for a few days. It sounded like McCann is almost an interim manager, the guy that holds him over until they even find who they want to the rest of the year. Is that accurate? What's the process in the short term going forward? Obviously, they're going to wait until they've got a front office in place to hire a full-time manager, but in the short term, what's the process going forward?
Yeah, that was probably the most confusing thing of that entire press conference, is he's going to be the interim manager through at least the weekend. I've never really heard of something like that before. There's no doesn't seem to me to be any internal candidates inside the organization that can handle that role. I thought if they did fire Ryan Sandberg in season, it was going to be one of two people, Juan Samuel or Pete Buchanan. So it was one of those two. I'm just really kind of confused as to what they could possibly do. Unless there's somebody out there that's sitting at home right now, fired in the last couple of years, and I'll have to kind of dig into that and see who might be out there. But unless there's one of those guys that, you know, say, hey, I'm going to take a year or two off from managing, and, you know, maybe I'll step back in it at some point, you know, then I think they maybe go in that direction. But I kind of think it might be Pete Buchanan for now, for the foreseeable future. But, yeah. Hey, I didn't think Ryan Sandberg was going to resign today, so what do I know?
And one last thing, we'll let you go, because, of course, there actually is work to be done for both of us. With the apparent impending hiring of McPhail, and again, it's not official and done, and the club is not saying anything, but all signs point to that that's coming and it's imminent. Does that tell you anything about direction? Does his history tell you anything? His philosophy? Is there anything you can be gleaned from that apparent choice at moving into some sort of senior role in the organization?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's a very Phillies-like choice, because they like the established, great resume type of executives. That's what they went for with Pat Gillick following the 2005 season, entering the 2006 season. He had a heck of a resume, and the Phillies felt comfortable with him. They loved his reputation in the game of baseball, and I think there's a little bit of that here. Now, we're not sure exactly what his role is going to be, but my expectation is that he will be some sort of president, CEO, and then either he will retain Ruben Amaro Jr. as general manager, or he will bring in a new general manager. So I think, you know, they like his resume. You know, he's two World Series with the Twins, brought the Cubs to the playoffs twice in 12 years, made some great trades to kind of help the Orioles kind of resurrect the franchise. And I think they're hoping that hand can kind of guide the next general manager, or the current general manager, the current front office, to, you know, getting this ship right sooner rather than later, because right now things look kind of bleak. You know, I talked to Pat Gillick earlier this week. I said, you know, hey, in spring training and in the offseason, you said 2017, 2018 will be the first time we'll contend again. Do you think he underestimated? He said, yes, it's probably going to take a little bit longer. And that's kind of a unsettling thought, I think, for Phillies fans. So I think they're hoping that McPhail can go in there and be a little bit more active and get this thing turned around rather quickly.
MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening.